It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with legendary choreographer Bill T. Jones.
But first, February is National Data Privacy Month. With so much of our personal stuff online, it can be difficult to know how our data is collected, used, and shared.
Whether it's creating secure passwords that we can actually remember or being aware of what we're sharing on social networks, there are some ways to make sure we're not giving away too much online.
For more on data privacy and how to keep our information safe, we turn to WPR's resident tech guy, Kevin Trueblood. Kevin, thanks for stopping by.
No, thanks for having me.
So when we say the words data privacy, what kind of data are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about information that you can use on any different website. And that can be medical records, it can be shopping records, credit card information, social security numbers. I mean, anything that you can share on the internet is the things that we're concerned about.
So what could someone who I don't want to know this stuff learn about me, whether it's a company, a government, nefarious international criminal hacker, what is out there about me that they could pick up if they know how to do it?
Well, essentially everything about you. I mean, these companies,
curses.
I mean, all these companies, like with Google and with Facebook, their whole mission is to basically get everything that they ever wanted to know about you onto their website. So everything that, you know, your family information, I mean, you can be as broad as your political affiliation all the way down to how many kids you have and what you had for dinner last night and where you ate your dinner last night. So all these sites collect all this information, and then other ones, like I said, your financial records and things like that. If you're doing your taxes online, that's all being stored on these different servers.
So I suppose the primary thing most people are worried about, though, is their money, their credit cards, and things like that. Is that the thing we need to be most concerned about rather than if someone knows that we had chicken casserole for dinner?
Well, and when we talk about privacy, there's a couple of different things to think about. And much like how you expect privacy from your doctor, there's laws that say that he can't or she can't share the information about you with anybody else. That's kind of what we're talking about here with these sites. There's an expectation that if you are giving your information to a website, let's say you're doing your taxes, you don't want that information to be shared with anybody else, or at least be aware that they are sharing that information with somebody else. So that's what we need to be concerned about. So we're talking about like credit card information. Yeah, you do want to definitely be aware of the sites that you're at least giving that information out to.
Now, there's some stuff, obviously, that appears to be beyond our control, given the stories we keep seeing about huge hacks of financial institutions and things like that. But let's talk about what we can do. And let's start by talking about what makes a good password and how we can set them up.
Yeah. Well, the best thing you can do is to have unique passwords for every site that you use. And that can be a daunting task considering how many sites that you use. We're talking about 40, 50 sites if you're paying your bills online, if you're shopping online. And that can be pretty tedious. And the reason why you want to have unique passwords is because, let's say there's a data breach, and this has happened at sites like Amazon, where they hack into the site and then they get all this information from these accounts. And now they have an account and they have a password that goes with that account. Well, if that's tied to your email, they can then go back to your email account and try that same password with your email account. Suddenly now they're into your email account. And from there, then they can reset your password on all these different sites or access all these different sites. And they can try this automatically. It's not like one person may be sitting around trying it individually. They can run a program that does it to a lot of different sites, which opens up a potential further data breach for yourself and potential identity theft. So the most basic thing you can do is, yes, have unique sites or unique passwords for different sites. And one of the best ways that you can do that too, there's a couple of different utilities that you can use. One called LastPass and another one's called KeepPass, which actually is a utility that runs on your computer. It stores the information on your local computer and it's encrypted, which creates unique passwords for these different sites for you. So not only do you not have to really remember them necessarily, but they're unique and they're secure. So that can help you in that sense. There's some discussion whether or not you should use whole words or if you should. Most sites will recommend that you use like a combination of, symbols and exclamation points and numbers and uppercase, lowercase. So there's some discussion there, and what I like to think of it is a happy medium. Create a couple of different words, but mix in some of the characters in there as well. But most importantly, that you can remember them. Because a password is only as good as if you can remember it. So if you have, you know, all these unique passwords, but you can't remember them, well, it doesn't do you any good.
Aren't there some websites that will help you remember them now, too, that will store all of your crazy unique passwords?
Yeah, well, a lot of sites have that option where to, like, save your password. And so if you're, like, on your home computer, you don't have to remember it every time you log in. But the problem is that if you try and use it on a public computer or something like that, then you don't know what your password is. It's kind of like having your address book on your cell phone and you can't remember your wife's phone number. There's some trade-off there. At the very minimum, one of the things you can do is you can create a single passphrase for your site and then have it dash LinkedIn, dash Gmail, for all the different services that you use. It's not ideal. It could be crackable, but it's something above just using the same password for every site.
Now let's turn from passwords to what we put on our social media network. So what are we putting on Facebook, say, or Twitter that we ought not to?
Well, you just got to remember that with Facebook, there, it's not so much as what you're posting, but also what you're liking, what you're sharing, what you're viewing with your friends. All of this goes into just a big database. And so if you're trying to be sensitive about the things that you want Facebook to know about you, that's something to keep in mind, that it's not so much what you may be posting yourself on your timeline, but also what you are engaging in, because all that gets collected and all that gets shared with advertisers and all the different parties that Facebook works with. So that's something to be mindful of, is not only what you yourself are posting, but also what you're engaging with the sites. And same thing with Google and same thing with Twitter. How you're engaging with the site makes a big difference. But also, there's that talk of obvious things on Facebook, like if you're checking in at some airport in Florida and talking about how it's 85 degrees and sunny and awesome, well, somebody may know that you're not home. So that's the obvious, and how you can help minimize that is by making sure that your accounts are maybe only viewable to the people that you're close to, or restrict the information that you're actually posting to the site.
Right, so that brings up another question. Are there things that we should just abstain from online? Because there are those people who say, I'm not going to share anything because it's going to be out there forever, and it's hackable. If we've learned anything in recent months, it's that anything is hackable, it seems like. So should we just dial it back?
Just live in a cabin in the North Woods and,
exactly.
And disconnect. It's unfortunately, it's one of the trade-offs. That risk is part of the trade-off of having the convenience of being online. And we are moving in that direction. And how you can help minimize that is to at least be aware of how these sites use your data and be mindful of what you are putting out there, and understanding that, you know, it may be somebody may be able to read it, or if somebody hacks into it, what are they going to have for you? But again, just being aware of sites' policies. Facebook has privacy controls. Most of these major sites have privacy controls. Just be aware of them and how you can use them to help minimize what other people are seeing.
And maybe we just need a new social media etiquette. Like, okay, I'm going to show you all my vacation photos after we get back.
Sure. Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
So, I mean, there's that kind of social engineering element to it, where we can just change our habits a little bit, still be able to get the benefits we want out of social media.
Right. That's absolutely right.
So anything in particular that you would recommend in terms of people who are especially, you know, cautious about this that we haven't covered already?
Well, I think that was the big thing, was just being aware of how the sites use the data that you are giving them. Facebook, you know, it has a long, and all these different sites have these long agreements that you just kind of glaze over and say agree to, but you know, just to be aware of, you know, how they're doing it. And there are some sites that that do simplify it for you and just make you aware of some of the big bullet points.
Now, a lot of us have our own Wi-Fi setups at home, mm-hmm. so we can connect our devices, our computers, TVs, or pretty soon I guess our refrigerators and stoves and everything to it. How do we protect our privacy? How hackable, how vulnerable are those things?
Well, those when they're on your own network, they are typically okay. If you're interacting with them on your own local network, as long as your network is secured, those devices are okay. If you're using some third-party application like Netflix, or if you're using Pandora or something like that, you are then subject to the terms of that site. But the devices within your house are not generally storing much information.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Kevin Trueblood, WPR's resident tech guy, with some tips for keeping our personal information safe during this February Data Privacy Month.
Coming up, we'll meet one of the world's leading figures in dance, artistic director and choreographer Bill T. Jones. That'll be coming up in just a little bit. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear about some of the concerns being raised over the new 50 Shades of Grey movie, such as the promotion of violence against women.
Our next guest is one of the leading figures in the world of dance and the arts. Bill T. Jones is the artistic director of New York Live Arts and the director, co-founder of the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company. In 2013, he was awarded a National Medal of Arts. In 1994, a MacArthur Genius Award.
Well, he's back in Wisconsin this month working with UW dance students and performing at the Memorial Union Shannon Hall in Madison on Saturday night. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, I know we had a little bit of a mix-up of time. We wanted you here so badly in the studio, but thank you for joining us where you are.
Yes, it's fine. It's fine. A little cold, but we're
Oh, no. Well, I hope you find some shelter. Well, you know, it's been 9 years since you've performed in Madison. What brings you back this time?
Well, we go where we're invited. So obviously the scheduling and the persons that be decided that it was time for us to come back, and we're with a wonderful music-driven program.
Now, the first time I saw your company, I was in college. It was a long time ago, and it's still seared into my mind. It was a performance I'm never going to forget. I remember it clearly. And at the time, I thought that I was someone who didn't understand dance. I didn't feel like that afterwards. What would you say to someone who might feel similarly, that there's someone who doesn't understand dance and what might happen if they go to see your performance?
Well, if they come to see the performance here, that in Madison tomorrow night, it is a very, very accessible program because the music is so interesting and so beautiful. The first piece is done to a Mozart Andante, which is it has its own kind of a rhythm, and the dancers, the energy coursing through their body, the lighting, the costumes, there's something very quirky but very, very danceable about it. It comes from an improvisation I did when I was working the Leonard Ballet, and I wanted to make an American sort of movement to Mozart. So I danced with it as I would have as a small boy in front of the jukebox in my my migrant labor family's home. And the results, you can see it in the hips and in the arms of the dancers. It's a lot of fun, and it's very, very beautiful. The second piece is a crazy piece called Continuous Replay that is just like its name. It's about the ability to play something forward and backwards, made by Arnie Zane, my now deceased co-director. And it's going to be actually a dance with some local dancers, some dancers from the university, I believe. And they are very, very excited, and we're excited to see them blend with my company. And the third piece is a hit from our repertoire called D-Man in the Waters, made in honor of one of the dancers who was dying of HIV, AIDS. And it was in the pieces, we often quote Jenny Holzer, the word artist, who says, "In a dream, you saw a way to survive, and it was filled with joy." So get ready, because it's about diving and swimming, and it's about beautiful musical phrases. It's loopy. It is. Audiences love it, and rightfully so. We're very, very proud of it.
Now, you mentioned your partner, Arnie Zane. You founded the company together in 1983, and he died of AIDS about 5 years later. And I've read that you used the dances that he performed in, that he choreographed, to inform the younger dancers in the company, to keep his spirit alive and his contribution.
Yes, his works, and we don't have a lot of works, but his works were really distinctive in its time. He was a photographer. He was a person that came to dance quite late. He was expert in karate. So the works have this kind of, at once, kind of a pictorial, picture-making, and a beautiful percussive clarity of gesture that comes with a mathematical mind, but something very hard to define. I can only say poetic. Yes, his works are a way for young dancers to understand what this company is about, where we have been, and where we're going.
Uh-oh. if you're not catching a cold out there.
Well, this is the end of a cold.
Oh, no. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned, I've read that you were an athlete before, and you said there's a lot of athleticism in your dances.
Yes,
and you were a runner, right, before you took
yes,
up dance?
Yes, I was a runner. And as a dancer, I've been retired now for 10 years, but as a dancer, I was also very interested in real displays of energy. I was a big jumper. I loved to roll. Arnie and I developed this style of dancing that was informed by contact improvisation, where we would actually yank each other around. Very much jiu-jitsu inspired, very much about leverage, so a small person could lift a big person. Those qualities, those athletic qualities, are very much in the choreography today.
Well, you've gotten into storytelling lately. You've got a new book out. It's called Storytime, The Life of an Idea. And it's, among other things, it's a collection of one-minute stories, an homage to the modernist composer John Cage. What do you think your dance and your work owes to John Cage?
Well, you know, from the very first time I started making work, it was, in some ways, I was responding to my African-American mother and father, who were mesmerizing storytellers. My father was always telling the kind of funny, some macabre story. My mother's stories were often cautionary, but very, very, very moving. So when I started doing contemporary dance, I had the idea, and not an original idea, but if I danced abstractly and I spoke, the audience, because the human mind is that way, would make connections in ways that I couldn't have foreseen. So the results would be greater than the sum of its parts. That philosophy still informs my ideas about storytelling. No, we don't do pantomime, or we do very, very little pantomime. But the stories are clear, and the audience they're watching this ever-shifting field of relationships, and they begin to unconsciously connect what they're hearing to what they're seeing. I think that's wonderful. They can own it, and they can also express things that tracking of this choreography in ways they would never be able to express in conversation. At least that's my impression of it. I stand by storytelling, but storytelling that is freed from a purely narrative purpose.
Right, and you've done a performance where there's a kind of random generator, right, where the stories come up in random order.
Well, that's definitely taken from Don Cage's famous indeterminacy. You know, this was one of the most radical ideas coming out of the mid-20th century, informed by the fact that the universe has an amazing unity to it. What looks like chaos to us, if viewed from the right point of view and long enough, you see pattern. He was tapping into that through his work in Zen Buddhism and Vedic philosophy. He was in some ways also having a big fight with German Romanticism, which teaches theme, variation, development, the ultimate and inevitable climax. He felt that all of those things were like a straitjacket, that it was very, very predictable. He wanted to help artists have tools to push past their comfort level. Hopefully, our dear audience comes with us, but that's a whole other question. He was a real hard nose. He was a wonderful man, but he really was first and foremost a fierce fighter for the new frontier. I am someone, I would probably be his grandchild, but I'm someone very influenced by his ideas, but there's a difference. I'm a black man who came of age in the 60s. The civil rights struggle. I am a black man who's trying to understand what power is and what the meaning of storytelling and meaning of my black body on stage. So John Cage, in some ways, was free of that, but he's given me a tool to get past my own seriousness and actually to at once be who I am, but talk about the possibilities in you viewing what I do. So John Cage is sort of my father, if not my grandfather. It's a kind of Freudian relationship. I have my dukes up a lot. You know, you want to punch your dad out? Well, a lot of us, we want to fight with our father, but we love them because they paved the way for us.
And
that's how I feel about John Cage.
You've met him, right?
Oh, yes, I knew him. I didn't know him deeply, but I went to dinner with him a couple of times, and he came to my show at least once.
Hmm. Well, you are 62 years old now, I've read. And at one point in your book, you
don't
say...
Don't tell anybody.
Sorry, it's out there. And at one point in your book, I think you say you're looking at some vintage clothes and someone holds up an old shirt and you say, yeah, I'm not really into nostalgia. But now that you have such an incredible career behind you, a lot of career ahead of you, but still a lot to be proud of in the rearview mirror, how do you think about the past and incorporate it as an artist?
How do I think about the past? This is quite a philosophical discussion for such an interview. Well, the past is almost the way, how do I feel about the sound of my mother's voice or of my father's hand? How do I feel about the music that informed me? How do I feel about people who died before I was even born? I can sometimes feel their presence in the way I walk, in my taste, in my anger. I have respect for the past, but I have a wary eye on it. I don't live in the past. I'm trying to live in this moment, something John Cage was very much about, something art is about. So when you see that piece on stage tomorrow night, the very first piece, Spent Days Out Yonder, in those first movements, try to imagine Bill T. Jones almost 15 years ago, working in a studio alone and improvising and hearing the Mozart music for the first time and his body responding. The past and the future are all one at that moment. And then they have another meaning, which is the now, which will happen in your theater tomorrow night. That's my belief. In some ways, that's my religion, my creed about art. We are all aware of the past, and it's oftentimes an obscene spectacle. But it's also a place where wonderful things happen. Witness the civil rights struggle. Witness the victories of your own personal making.
And I wish we could keep going, but we're out of time. Bill, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And please, everyone, come on down and have a good time.
That was Bill T. Jones, artistic director, choreographer, and dancer, co-founder of the Bill T. Jones Arnie Zane Dance Company.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at the controversy over the 50 Shades of Grey movie. Harmless fun, or does it help normalize abuse? That's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, Governor Walker's administration has proposed some modifications to his UW system budget proposals. We'll take a look at the details.
First, one of the most talked about movies of the year so far is set to hit theaters tomorrow. Based on the best-selling book of the same title, 50 Shades of Grey has been described as a cultural phenomenon. More than 100 million copies of the book have been sold. The movie's expected to pull down some serious cash as well. Here's a clip.
It's just beyond this door.
What is?
My playroom.
Like your Xbox and stuff?
It's important that you know you can leave at any time.
Why? What's in there?
I meant what I said. The helicopter's on standby to take you whenever you want to go.
Couldn't you just open the door?
As you probably heard by now, the plot of 50 Shades of Grey revolves around the sexual relationship between main characters Anastasia Steele and Christian Grey, and features explicit depictions of sexual practices like bondage, submission, and domination. Fans of the series say it's harmless fantasy, but others have concerns that 50 Shades is promoting domestic abuse and maybe violence against women.
Amy Bonomi has done research on this topic. She's professor and chair of the Human Development and Family Studies Department at Michigan State University, where she looks at the long-term health effects of things like domestic violence and dating violence. She's authored two studies on the potential harmful effects of 50 Shades of Grey. Amy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So as I just mentioned, you've done some studies looking at the books 50 Shades of Grey, the series. You've authored a couple of pieces. What exactly were you looking for when you analyzed the book?
So in our first study, we took national definitions of domestic violence from the Centers for Disease Control, and we were really analyzing the book to better understand the abuse patterns that exist in the relationship between Christian and Anastasia. And in a follow-up study, we then surveyed women to ask about their readership of 50 Shades as well as their exposure to a range of health risks.
And did you see health risks of various sorts among the women who are reading 50 Shades?
We did. So in our study of about 700 women, women who read the 50 Shades books were at increased risk of having a verbally abusive partner, having a partner who showed stalking tendencies, so showing up in person when a person doesn't want them to, unwanted phone calls and text messages. They also showed signs of disordered eating, binge drinking, and having five or more intercourse partners in their lifetime.
So is this something where the book is causing this, or it's kind of a correlation. People who have these other things going on in their lives might be more prone to like this book.
Right. So our study couldn't determine causality, but we're arguing that the direction is really inconsequential. So if women experience these adverse health behaviors first, reading 50 Shades has a potential to reaffirm those experiences. And if they read 50 Shades before experiencing the health behaviors, it's possible the book could influence the onset of the behaviors.
Now, a lot of the attention to the books and now the movie are to its treatment to bondage, BDSM. And a lot of people say if done right, that's BDSM is okay. It's healthy, it's fun, as long as there's consent. So is the problem you see with 50 Shades that it portrays bondage and other activities or something else?
So you're exactly right. There's nothing inherently wrong with BDSM or bondage discipline, sadism, masochism, insofar as both parties consent in the activities and there's mutual agreement upon what the activities are going to be beforehand. So what we see in the relationship between Kristen and Anastasia is very different. Alcohol is used to impair Anastasia's consent, and there's intimidation and pressure used in a lot of their sexual interactions. In fact, Kristen begins a lot of their sex scenes when he's genuinely angry at Anastasia, and that's very different than what we know about traditional BDSM relationships.
So let's get into the text and I suppose the movies. You are actually seeing behaviors in this that meet definitions, almost everyone's definitions of abuse, of domestic violence in some cases, domestic abuse. What kind of behaviors in the book meet those definitions?
Sure. So Kristen uses an interlocking pattern of abuse to control basically Anastasia's every move. So what are those behaviors? He stalks her. He intimidates her through a lot of verbal tactics. He isolates her from friends and family, so he gets angry at her when she gets together with friends, for example. And he minimizes the abuse that he inflicts. And so that's a very characteristic of abusers, to basically turn the abuse blame back on the victim. The other thing that he does that's very concerning is perpetrating sexual violence, and I mentioned that just a minute ago. He uses alcohol to impair her consent, as well as intimidates her and pressures her to participate in sex acts that she's uncomfortable with.
Now, there's one argument I've seen related to the books and the movie that, yes, these things are bad, but it's okay to have this fantasy presented about bad things. It doesn't mean that it will lead people to participate in these behaviors. It doesn't mean they really want these things to happen. This is a harmless way to play out maybe a dangerous fantasy.
So that's exactly right. So we're not suggesting that the books be banned or that the movie be banned, but really trying to raise awareness to get people to think more critically about the fiction that they're consuming and the films that they're consuming. So to recognize the warning signs of abuse, particularly the warning signs of abuse that we're seeing in the relationship between Kristen and Anastasia.
Do you worry that reading these books, these behaviors being presented as ultimately appealing to the female character here, that this runs the risk of normalizing these patterns of abuse?
Absolutely. So this book is a glaring glamorization of violence against women. It really is perpetuating abuse standards. And so what the problem is that women who may be experiencing abuse in their relationship, having this type of cultural environment, whether it be fiction, film, music, that is perpetuating these types of abuse standards, makes it difficult for them to be able to distinguish when abuse is actually occurring in their own relationship.
I wanted to talk book versus movie here. The book is graphic. It presents these scenes, like you said, but it leaves it to our interpretation, the imagination in some cases. Do you worry that things that you're saying about the book may be magnified on the big screen since we're actually seeing it happen?
I actually have seen the film, so I'm not too worried about that. Just sort of as I mentioned just a second ago, it's just the overarching the underlying context in which we're all situated in our society with music and film. Really, those critical conversations teaching youth at very young ages to understand warning signs for abuse, to understand what healthy sexuality is, healthy body image, healthy sexual expression is really a critical need we have across our society.
So, as you mentioned, you're not looking for the book or the movie to be banned. Do you think, though, by and large, we'd be better off not reading it, not seeing it?
No, not necessarily. Like I said, just the real critical thing. I mean, this is a great opportunity for us to open a societal dialogue about violence against women in the same way that the Ray Rice case sort of brought to light issues of domestic violence in society in general, not just the NFL.
So let's talk maybe from the perspective of a parent. I guess kids, teens probably may read these books, may see the movie, whether their parent wants them to or not. How would a parent open up that conversation about what goes on in the book, in the movie, and what should go on in reality?
So a great place to start is to, you know, talk to me about your reactions of the film. What were your perceptions of the relationship in the film? Tell me what drew you to like the relationship, what didn't you like in the relationship, to sort of open up the conversational space for young people to disclose what they are drawn to, what they're not drawn to sort of tease out some of the nuances and how people's perceptions are around relationships.
And should people be examining their own lives? You mentioned in your in the second study you mentioned, you talked to women who had read or surveyed women who had read 50 Shades of Grey and saw some unhealthy things happening in their lives, including being victims of various types of abuse. How should they be thinking about this book? How can we reach them to say, well, in fact, the book isn't normal. These are not good things to be happening in your life.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great question. So I think our study is one step in that direction. So it really is, you know, bringing to light some of the patterns that we're seeing among readers and non-readers. So opening a conversational space that these are health risks that we see. And we do see prior empirical studies that have shown similar associations between, you know, for example, those who are exposed to pornography and added toward violence against women, as well as children who play with violent video games and aggression in their own relationships. So, you know, we've taken a look at it from a fiction perspective here.
We're talking with Amy Bonomi about the upcoming film 50 Shades of Grey. She's looked at the book and women who read the book and some of the unhealthy, dangerous behaviors portrayed in the book, and now looking at the film, wondering if it could promote domestic abuse, violence against women, and we want to hear from you on this.
Have you read the books? Are you planning to see the movie? Do you think there is something to this worry that 50 Shades of Grey could promote violence against women, or do you see it as harmless fantasy, as fiction? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up a conversation in just a moment after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with Amy Bonomi about the new film 50 Shades of Grey, how it might be, the concern is, perpetuating domestic abuse, violence against women. This is a monster-selling book, likely to be a top movie come the end of the weekend. We want to hear what you think about it. There have been some protest organizers saying they're going to be protesting the opening of the movie in Wisconsin and around the country. You could call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you read the book? The books, actually? Are you planning on going out to see the movie? Do you think it is a harmless fantasy, or is it degrading to women, maybe ultimately endorsing domestic violence? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a Jim in Viroqua now to start us off. Jim, hi.
Hi there.
What do you think about this?
I'm not calling to specifically disagree with your guest. I actually haven't heard most of the interview up to this point, but I just wanted to say that I haven't read 50 Shades of Grey. I don't plan on seeing the movie. I don't plan on ever reading it. And I'm not sure if it necessarily promotes violence against women, but I think it's more indicative of a level of violence that permeates our culture as a whole.
Jim, thanks for the call. Interesting point. Maybe the book doesn't cause more damage, Amy, but it's reflecting pervasive elements in our society.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the book is a manifestation of the general tolerance that we have for violence against women in society in general. And I think we're seeing that in the demonstration in the book, but clearly violence against women is normative in our society as well.
Now, this you're saying that you're hoping this starts a conversation, that the release of the movie gets us talking about these issues. That's part of what we're doing here right now. From what you've seen in the media, are you seeing a positive conversation being triggered in response to the movie release?
Yeah, so I think it is opening a conversation. So the debate that's happening, you know, the proponents of the film and the opponents, it's good that the dialogue is occurring. So it's a healthy conversation to have debate about what this movie is depicting, the different perspectives and how people can empower themselves in their own lives through these conversations.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Gloria on the line in La Crosse. Gloria, hi.
Hi. I was just going to say that, you know, I see this as one form of entertainment. You know, I watched Downton Abbey. I wouldn't want to be Lady Mary and have all the restrictions she has on her freedoms and her, you know, inability to express her intelligence. But I enjoy Downton Abbey. And similarly, I think you can read works of fiction and not necessarily agree with everything that happens to someone in it, but enjoy it for its art form.
Gloria, thanks for the call. So maybe we could appreciate 50 Shades of Grey as a story, as storytelling, and not be affected by an underlying message.
Absolutely. And I think the important point that she raises is what are the critical factors that allow somebody to see it as fiction and other people to take in the messages and potentially have it have a harmful impact on them?
Gloria, thanks a lot for the call. I don't want to dance around a side issue here too much. I haven't read the book myself. The reputation of it is not particularly well written, not well crafted as a story. Does that matter one way or the other to the issues of domestic violence and abuse that we're talking about, or is that just a sidelight?
I think it's a side bite. I mean, clearly, when we did our systematic analysis and in examining really every interaction between Kristen and Anastasia using the Centers for Disease Control's definitions of domestic violence, we did show those widespread, consistent patterns of abuse that we see in domestically abusive relationships.
It seems like a key issue that we're talking about here is the issue of consent, and that's the big objection in the story that is told in 50 Shades of Grey. There's been a lot of talk on university campuses and elsewhere trying to promote this consent message. Do you see things changing? Are we paying more attention to that?
Well, there definitely are, you know, widespread societal conversations occurring right now, particularly on college campuses, around sexual violence and consent, and it is a critical conversation that we need to continue to have because we're just barely scratching the surface. We're in the infancy of those conversations. So this book is yet another means for us to open those conversations and have them more frankly in society. We need to do a much better job, starting very young, as I mentioned earlier, starting very young in grade school, through high school and into college. You know, we know children are affected very early on by messaging, so talking with them about these ideas is important early on.
Go back to our callers now as we talk about 50 Shades of Grey with researcher Amy Bonomi. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Is there a damaging message here? 800-642-1234. We go now to Julie with us in Milwaukee. Julie, hi.
Hi. Actually, that's not my real name, but just for anonymity's sake, I want to tell you that I'm a psychologist. In my 50s, so I've had a lot of both life experience and experience with a lot of men and women where I have the privilege of being able to really understand in a deep way their own selves and relationships. And I'm sorry, I don't know the speaker's name today.
Amy?
Amy? Mm-hmm. Amy, I think you're spot on. I, like many women, had to learn through my young adulthood, till my late 30s, what sexual coercion is within all other ways seems to be a loving relationship. And we're just barely helping young women understand what happens when they barely know the person, like date rape and that sort of thing. But it gets even much more confusing. That's confusing enough. But much more confusing when they believe they're consenting to something they really don't want.
Julie, thanks a lot. You bring up a great point, Amy, talking about within a relationship, what
one might otherwise look at as a loving relationship, and yet there's this coercion, this lack of consent, and trying to untangle that core coercion, the core abuse and violence from the rest of the relationship.
That's exactly right. I mean, she raises a very, very critical point in the sense that, you know, oftentimes when we think about sexual violence, we think about rape, penetration. But in many relationships, including especially those involved intimate partners or dating partners, there is something what we call verbal sexual coercion, which can come in very subtle forms and is an insidious form of sexual violence in terms of pressuring somebody to participate in activities that they are not comfortable with, whether that be intercourse, touching somebody, making somebody touch them when they don't want them to, that kind of thing.
And one of the criticisms I've seen of 50 Shades of Grey is the notion that that Anastasia, the female character, can change Christian Grey, that she can take these negatives and, I guess, work away from them and make it a positive relationship. And that's often often a road that women can't go down in the long run.
Well, right, and what we showed in our analysis as well is that Anastasia suffers the reactions that are typical of abused women. So she suffers; she's constantly feeling what we call perceived threat. So something dangerous is going to happen in the relationship. She engages in stressful managing. So she feels like she's walking on eggshells. She begins to change her behavior over time so as not to upset Christian, not to anger him. She loses her identity, and she becomes disempowered and entrapped in the relationship in response to his abuse.
Thanks a lot for the call. Brought up some very good issues. We'll go now to Adriana in Bayfield. Adriana, hi.
Hi. I think I'm in the minority here listening to this broadcast, but I actually don't think that the book promotes violence against women. I mean, I will definitely agree that there were, even when I was reading it, some things that distressed me a little. I mean, the, like, hyper-stalkerish tendencies of Christian Grey are definitely disturbed me a little bit, but I don't think that the like, BDSM nature of the book itself promotes violence against women. Now, are there some things there that definitely should be talked about as far as the way that Christian acts towards Anastasia? Yes, absolutely. But I don't think that the book in and of itself is promoting violence against women or is even condoning it necessarily. So thank you very much.
Adriana, thanks for the call. Amy, your thoughts?
Well, so that's a great point. So essentially, to go back to, there's nothing inherently wrong with BDSM, again, as long as the parties are consenting and they mutually agree upon the activities. We see a very different pattern, though, in 50 Shades, where the consent is violated through the use of alcohol and intimidation and pressure. And outside of the sexual interactions, the interlocking pattern of abuse that I described of Christian stalking, following Anastasia, hounding her with text messages and phone calls, the expensive gifts that he gives, those are all warning signs that when we're talking with young people, people in high school and people in college about what are the warning signs for abuse, it's that jealousy, it's that stalking, it's the intimidation, it's the verbal types of abuse that we see in that relationship between Christian Grey and Anastasia Steele.
Go back to our callers. We've got Catherine on the line in La Crosse. Catherine, hi.
Hello. Yes, I mean, I do not support the book or the movie. I really enjoy hearing what your speaker is saying about how it is coercive and it's hurtful. I just don't see it as contributing to a joyful, productive relationship, the give and take. I see it as very coercive.
Catherine, thanks a lot for the call. Amy, she agrees with you. What kind of messages would you like people to be talking about now as they come out of the theater, maybe, if they pick up the book and read it? What are the key things you want people to be talking about and thinking about after 50 Shades of Grey?
Sure. So I guess the critical thing is, was Anastasia empowered in the relationship? Did she have choice and agency in helping to shape the relationship that she wanted? You know, typically in the abusive relationships and what we see in 50 Shades of Grey is that she's lacking that agency. She is perceiving threat and having stressful managing and losing her identity and becoming disempowered. So I would, you know, we'd be very interested in knowing what young people think, particularly young people, and whether they feel she's empowered, and if she's not, how is she not?
Briefly, plans to study people's reactions to the movie like you did with the books?
Yes, we are taking 40 undergraduates to the theaters this weekend, and we are going to do focus groups with them, discussions with them afterwards about their perceptions of their relationship.
Sounds like an interesting conversation. Amy, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Amy Bonomi. She's professor and chair of the Human Development and Family Studies Department at Michigan State University, where she looks at the long-term health impacts of domestic violence and dating violence. She authored two studies on the potential harmful effects of 50 Shades of Grey.
Coming up, we'll get the details on potential changes to Governor Walker's budget proposals for higher education. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.